Certified financial planner Dave Petzo. Dave answers your questions about personal finance. He provides insight into making the most on your money using over 20 years of experience. Money Matters is brought to you in part by Petzo Financial Consultants and Mountain West Bank, Idaho's community bank, with offices in Boise, Ketchum, and Coeur d'Alene. Dave Petzo, the host of Money Matters, is a certified financial planner professional and an investment advisor representative with Cambridge Investment Research Advisors Incorporated. Registered representative securities offered through Cambridge Investment Research Incorporated, a broker-dealer member FINRA SIPC. Investment advisor representative Cambridge Investment Research Advisors Incorporated, a registered investment advisor. Cambridge Investment Research Incorporated and Petzo Financial Consultants are not affiliated companies. And now the host of Money Matters, Dave Petzo.
Hello and good morning. Another all-time high. Week after week, right? We tried to pull back a few weeks ago. No. A few weeks before that, no. And we moved to all-time highs. You know, it's funny. I'm going to talk a little bit today. I want to talk about the lessons of 2014. And some are kind of personal lessons, too. But, you know, things you have to learn, you have to grow. And, yeah, I've been doing this a long time. And the longer you do it, the more you realize you don't know. You don't know. You can't know the future. And that's really the hardest thing for us to do. It's remarkable, isn't it remarkable how much energy we expend, how much time in contemplation of what the future will bring, especially with something like the market. Yeah, I've said it many times, you know, but it always bears repeating, at least it does in my head. Maybe you guys get lessons like the first time out of the chute. I don't. I have to be reminded of things like that. Of when you get something right, or even a few times in a row you get it right. To not be arrogant because you know you're going to be really wrong soon. Because everybody is. Nobody's right all the time. And reminding yourself that if you get lucky on something, it's luck. It's not genius. Yeah, as we try to remind ourselves of all these things, and I remind myself of the same lessons over and over, so that hopefully I don't fall back into the same rut, right? The same problem. And I think, so the theme for me, as I kind of think about 2014, is right back to one of my Ten Commandments. It's number one, actually. First one, meaning. Not necessarily number one and most important, but the first one that I always talk about. And again, these are my investment commandments. They don't have to be yours. They're reminders to me of the things that I feel, think, have my own biases towards that I need to conquer in order to have any chance of any success in investing. And that is this. What I know isn't worth knowing. And to me, 2014 was classic of that. And most years are, aren't they? Otherwise, you wouldn't have a commandment. It wouldn't be like, you know, once in a while, this is a good thing to remember. No, it always is. I get that. But this year was kind of like this. This is what your big lesson is, your big takeaway for 2014 is. Now, why do I say that? Because as I look at 2014, and I look at all of the different data points as we were going through the year, the news, if you will, which of course, as I say over and over, is the old, it's a historic report, has nothing to do with what's going to transpire tomorrow. But we breathlessly wait for these things, as if it gives us an indication of what's going to happen. And when we listen to people dancing around saying, it's it's all about oil. It's all about oil. It's all about oil. And then the next day, it's, well, it's not really all about oil because, you know, it's not doing what it was doing yesterday. But, you know, and they give you another reason why they're right today. All of the news is about being the king of what's happening now. And pretending to be on the cutting edge of something that has nothing to do with anything. Like, you know, the key to the market today is oil. And that's why it's not. Because that key mysteriously is moving in the opposite direction today. Because yesterday actually wasn't the key. This is something we look at. I go, oh, you know, I wonder why the market went up 100 points. Let me see if I can find something out there that moved. And then we'll call it the reason for the market doing something. And why this is important is because it leads us to distort our thought process about what we think is important and what we know and how we can drive that forward. And so as I think about this, I think about all the craziness and the noise that's going on all the time. Making up stories. I'm literally making up stories that have nothing to do with whether you should be owning the great corporations of the world. Nothing. Nothing whatever. I had to show this chart thing. Let's go to the charts. Let's go to the charts. We've got nothing to talk about. Let's talk about charts. There's not really any news out there. Let's go and talk about charts. This one looks bad. Let's go to the Florida State. Let's talk about what number, if the S&P hits, you know, 1983, that's it. You know, that it's all hands on deck. Because we're plunging to, you know, 1980 without any resistance or whatever. Nonsense. Absolute nonsense. But what this does breathe in our mind, we need to be listening, we need to be hearing, we have more stuff, we've got to learn. And what you know, what I know, isn't worth knowing. But it's reported breathlessly, and we think we should know. And we hear things. As an example, just this past year, we've heard many times that the only reason that corporate profits were rising was because of corporate buybacks. Do you remember that? The corporations weren't really growing, right? They weren't really having new revenues. I've heard this song and dance since the bottom in 2009. Literally. The people have been like, you know, I don't even have any idea why they're still on TV. They're like, wrong for decades. Except for, like a stock watch as well. Oh, there's a bear market. Where's that bear again? Oh, yeah, let's get him out. Let's pull him out of hibernation. Let's put him on TV. Let's talk about how smart he is. Because the market pulled back in a temporary correction on its way relentlessly higher. But we hear it. We hear this. And we hear this, like, first of all, it started with corporate profits are up. Yeah, they're higher. But sales aren't. Sales are disappointing. In other words, they're cutting costs by, you know, cutting jobs. Not having as much inventory. Cutting back on factories. But sales really aren't there. Well, seriously, the same people who told you sales really weren't there, when actually they were there, and they kept growing rapidly, now move on. See, because actually it's just not true. Nobody's buying into the no sale option anymore. Corporations are selling more stuff everywhere. So we move on. So you don't worry, because they'll be back with something else. And then they come back, and now it's the corporate profits aren't really very good. It's just margins are better. Oh, okay, so peak margins, got peak margins. And the margins can't get any better. So therefore, when margins go back down, and that's, of course, how much profit you make, margins are, how much profit you make off of each sale. Like if you sell a dollar worth of goods and you make 10 cents, will that be a 10% margin? Before you pay taxes and et cetera, capital costs, all those things. And a very important number, it is, no question. And so we went from it's not really growing sales to margins can't get any better. So today's since margins did get better, or stayed remarkably good, and corporate profits kept growing, and sales were growing, now we have clues to know to explain why there's all a demand problem, and now we've got it. Ah, corporate profits are being made up really only by the stock buybacks, not by real growth. It's manufactured. So it's not real. So the 10% increase in profit per share is really being driven by stock buybacks, not real growth in the corporation. You ready for what the next one is before I even answer this one? I can smell it. I can smell it. It's going to be corporations can't grow organically, so they're having to buy other ones. They're merging. That's the only, that's coming up. I just know it. Feel it in my bones. That's the next one coming. You really can't have real growth. So, it's phony. It's phony if you go buy another company. Coming next. Let me answer the current one. And I think I touched on this a few weeks back. It's not about this. But it doesn't stop people who don't ever do any homework. They just regurgitate what everybody else said. And nobody ever says, Joe, that's just absolutely wrong. This is simply not true. Buybacks account for a tiny, tiny piece. Tiny. Way less than 10% of the profit growth. It's from earnings. Because earnings are growing. It's from multiple expansion. Why the market's going up. That's multiple expansion. Multiple expansion means the fact that the market maybe doesn't sell for 15 times earnings. It expands because where else in the whole wide world are you going to put money? I realize we've got a whole lot of machinations to understand it. We've really got to suck on how phony this guy is, and we've got to turn off phony every immunity. And this just said stop. This is all going to go away. Don't I understand? Yeah, I do. And when you circle something on the calendar, we're going to go away, have it go away. And then we come and go. The market moves to all-time highs. And the Fed stopped, like the Fed they stopped, when the economy was able to stand on its feet, which it seems to be doing. And the market just didn't do what everybody said it would do. Because what everybody knows isn't worth knowing. Again. Interest rates rising. Another lesson. Interest rates rising will devastate the stock market. And I've talked about this many times because it is constantly, constantly talked about on TV like it's just this known thing. Which this known thing is not a true thing. It's not true at all. It's not. When interest rates are super low, like they are, how do we define super low? Well, today it is, but I'll actually give you a definition. How about below 5%? When an interest rate rises, almost always the stock market is up. And when interest rates rise, when interest rates are below 4%, 100% of the time, the market's higher. That's not what you heard. It's not what you hear. Because one guy says it, nobody ever checks. That's totally assumed ignorance. Interest rates rise, stock market's in rough shape. The lesson for me, 2014, many lessons, is to remember, though, that what I know and what I think I know from the people that I think I'm hearing stuff from isn't worth knowing. And the thing is, it's not just because it's wrong sometimes. That's really the second part of that. And that's really like, what do I know that is wrong? Right? Where my bias is wrong? What is driving this particular, let's say, market condition when I thought it would be X? What's the market telling me? And as we look at that, not because we want to trade stocks, but we come to the conclusion that you can't. You won't get it right. You can't know the future. You can't. You can't. I know it's not going to stop you from being smarter than everybody else and doing it. I got it. People have to do what they have to do. But I think that's the point of once in a while reflecting. And soon we're going to all reflect on what's going to happen in 2015, which is not what's going to happen, whatever it is you think. It'll be something different. Probably quite a bit different. And it'll undoubtedly be vastly different than whatever the consensus is, because the consensus is almost always wrong, because the consensus doesn't really ever really predict anything. Markets don't do normal. And prediction only can draw straight lines. A to B to C to what's going to happen next year? Correct, to D. All in a straight line. That's how markets do. They don't do normal. They don't do straight lines. They don't do predictions. Which is why the consensus is almost always wrong. But that's okay, because over the next couple of weeks we'll breathlessly be listening. Or no, breathlessly be telling us. We can choose to turn it off. Well, that's not even of any interest to me. What that person thinks, because they're wrong. Sounds just like the last guy. It'll still happen. But it'll also, and here's the funny thing, it'll actually cause people to change their investment plan. Even though they know you can't know the future. What we know isn't worth knowing. 2014 was yet another classic example after example after example after example. Ebola has a 3-week period. Nothing good can happen. As they just kind of see NBC desk and their heads are down and scratching. Oh my God. It's all horrible. Mark the bottom. Dead bottom. Really? That point? Mark the bottom. But you know, it isn't worth knowing. Oil prices are going up, they're going down. They do this, they do that, they don't. They don't. They do today, they don't tomorrow. Interest rates rising. It's actually good for stocks, not bad. But it could be bad for stocks, depending on what level they're at. Huh? Yeah, when interest rates are high and rising, that's bad. That's bad. So be careful what our assumptions are. Be careful all the fear mongers, the constant driving of noise, which is what it is. And the lesson really to draw from 2014 is this. Own the great corporations of the world. And don't let the fear mongers scare you out of them. They may go down for a day or two, but they're going higher. They always do. Always have. And I believe always will. Interruptions many times. Great pullbacks, great fear. And then the march continues. As the great corporations adapt to whatever net jobs there are in the White House, anti-business people, tax and spenders, or economic catastrophes. They adapt, find new markets, new products, and grow. And yeah, they buy back stock. They sell more stuff and increase the cash flow to their stockholders called dividends. Buy them and hold them and turn down the noise. I gotta take a quick break. When I come back, I need your phone calls. You can also take your emails. Love to do that too. It's dave@petsofinancial.net. I'm here only in the first hour. Second hour, we're going to rerun Neil Devlin. It's kind of a holiday season. I know there's not as many people out there. That's why I really need you to give us a call. 580-KIDO. We'll be right back.
This is Money Matters with Dave Petzo. Dave is taking calls right now. Call.
Hello, welcome, and thank you for joining us. 580-5436 is our number, 580-KIDO. I would love to hear from you. But we need your phone calls, no doubt about it. And thanks again to Jennifer Stone and Tom Brown for running with the program last week, and what a great job they did. And thank you all for all the phone calls last week. That was great. They really were really jacked up and enjoyed it very much. So, and thanks again to them for pitching in. As we head to our to the end of another successful market year, you know, as I talked about a couple weeks ago, the market indices are incredibly misleading, because what we're talking about when we talk about the S&P 500 are the mega companies. There's nothing wrong with investing in the mega companies. But mega companies, only U.S., does not include small cap. It does not include foreign. It doesn't include any bonds. And so as we look at equity income funds, which are absolutely some of my favorites, have a few bonds, a few different size companies, typically focused on dividend payers, they had a fine year, but not an S&P 500 year. When we add anything foreign, oh my, oh my, oh my. But we always arbitrarily measure things from January to December and then January to December again. And it's arbitrary because I don't know why we don't go from March to March, or we have a 15-month or 15-month and 3-day measurement period. But we don't. We have a set period. And so over short periods of time, people can have great feelings of what they should be doing. And this was a classic year of one asset group vastly outperforming. It's just a very, very classic of a focus on one area. But it's very unusual that one area will be so far and away the best returning area. And that was the mega cap S&P. And I don't want to go back through that. If you do want that, that program's out on our website. And I think it was a couple weeks ago. And I talked about it in the second hour, beginning of the second hour, breaking down the different indices and trying to be thoughtful about what it is you're trying to put together instead of willy-nilly every other year going, hey, I don't know why I don't own more foreign after foreign's done really well. I'm not sure why I don't own more small cap after small cap's done really well. And then we look at this year, and there's always a lot of noise because the most highly indexed index is the S&P 500, which is a mega cap, and that is this year's shining star by far. By far. But it's real easy to be thinking, wow, I should probably change my whole portfolio around. Why shouldn't I? And there's a number of really good reasons that will be quoted by people as to why it's really like international investing, because these companies are basically large, you know, multinationals. There really is 50 of the biggest companies, U.S. only, of the biggest. It really is a lot about Apple. It's the biggest. I mean, imagine we talk about an index that one company alone, has a massive influence on. Let's say you worked at Micron, and a huge part of yours was your overall net worth was in Micron options. A huge part of your net worth. And so you look at your net worth as an example at the end of the year, and you go, man, I'm such a good investor. Well, look how much I grew last year. What does that have to do with anything? You have Micron, and Micron had a phenomenal year. Now, maybe you did on the rest of your investments, but you really need to analyze those separately, comparing to a reasonable index. It's hard not to be emotional about why don't I have more here? Why didn't I put less there? And investing is hard. It's hard on your emotions because the fact of the matter is no matter how good people are, they're wrong a lot. That's a tough one. It's a really hard one. All right, give me a break here. It's 580-5436. 580-KIDO. It's Dave at PetroFinancial.net. We need to take a break for Fox News. We still have 30 minutes left today live, so do give us a call. We'll be right back.
This is Money Matters with Dave Petzo. Dave is taking calls right now. Call 580-5436, Idaho's place to talk. KIDO, Idaho's place to talk.
Hello, welcome, and thanks for joining us. 580-KIDO is our number. 580-5436. Please do this call live this hour. They have a recording in the next hour. Neil Devlin, which was like employee number 10 for John Templeton. I talked with him. Oh, gosh, I think this was our third interview this year, third time we talked with him this year. So, but when we run that, I know it's a holiday season and people are sleeping in and also for those of you who are not, please do give us a call. We'd love to hear from you. And what kind of 2014, what kind of questions do you have going forward for 2015? Year-end portfolio rebalancing to me is one of those things that you just have to do. And it's easy not to do because what you're really going to be doing is selling off some of the stuff that is really working good. And who wants to do that? That's kind of crazy, like shooting the horse to win the race. Nobody wants to do that. And there's every reason under the sun, especially, this is the hardest part, right? Because all the news is positive when prices are high. It speaks to, here's what was really good, and because it's really good, and it looks really good, and prices can go up really high, we still think it's going to go really good. And you don't want to miss out. And of course, then you've got the whole crowd of people over here yelling and screaming all the time on the stuff that isn't working, right? That maybe is kind of cheap, certainly cheaper than other stuff, right? But the outlook isn't as good, and there's a whole laundry list of reasons why it didn't do good, and they're not all resolved, are they? And I think about that, and I think about the lessons just in this year. I mean, very specific to help me stay on track, and it's like this. So the market is tanking. It's October 15th, and we got this whole new thing, a deadly disease, Ebola. And the news couldn't be worse. You know, somebody's been, like, on an airplane running around the country who's infected. It just can't possibly be worse. And there's some kind of, and then we hear there's like a 3-week incubation period. It can't be worse. And this is on top of what's going on in Ukraine and actually other serious worries, right? Not that Ebola should be like, you know, can you believe they were worried about that? But seriously, can you? Can you believe a market veteran like Jim Cramer is like nearly weeping on his desk that it can't get better because of Ebola? Not because of Ukraine. This is how emotional it can be, even for professionals. Experienced professionals. Right? It's an emotionally charged thing. On October 15th, the market bottomed on that. It didn't come up with a cure for what everybody that morning and the week before was terrified of. And the reason it was given always that the market was going down. What we know isn't worth knowing because it's already priced in the market. It's in. So as we get to this year end and you kind of rebalance and you kind of push money back over here and do things that nobody likes, that isn't working. We had a bad year. Why would I do that? You don't think that's emotional? Of course it is. Of course it is. You're taking money out of what worked, and everybody says it's going to keep working, and then they put it in stuff that nobody thinks is going to work, and it was really bad last year. It'll look terrible. Why would I do that? You do it because that's the rule. That's the plan. That's how you do it. You just do it, right? You don't exercise on mornings that you feel like exercising. You do it. You don't just, like, push away the food you shouldn't eat when you feel like it. Because you don't feel like it all the time. And you don't rebalance your portfolio because you feel like it's a bottom in these things. You just do it. You just do it. And then sometime later when those things start working, and then they're all dancing around on TV about how good they are, and now your portfolio is disproportionately sized on those things, you rebalance again. Because it's what you do as a discipline, right? That's what we have to do, is be disciplined. Because we're human beings, and we're not. We're not. So we have to have rules, and we have to follow them. Our number is 580-5436-580-KIDO. Dave@petzofinancial.net. We'll be right back.
This is Money Matters with Dave Petzo. Dave is taking calls right now. Call 580-5436, Idaho's place to talk. It's Money Matters with Dave Petzo on 580 KIDO, Idaho's place to talk.
Hello, welcome, man. Thanks for joining us. Hey. You know, nobody's helping me out here. I don't know. Did I make you mad? I mean, we could use some phone calls, seriously. 580-KIDO. Thanks again to Tom Brown, Jennifer Stone for pitching in last week and doing a great job. They are just awesome. I'll tell you something. You know, I'm such a fortunate person. I really am. To be surrounded by people like that every day. Every single day. I mean, it just goes on. Teresa, Jenny, all the people in the office, are just, I get to work with my dad. I mean, what an incredible thing to go to work every day. It's not work. It's fun. It's fun to be with these folks, and it really is. And so, you know, I don't really mean to get too chappy over the holiday season here, but it's just a nice thing to reflect on is how wonderful things are. And that kind of leads me to this, my thought here that I just want to, I guess, kind of finish up today's program with, and that is that, you know, being skeptical all of the time, it not only sucks as just like a miserable existence, it really does. You're just not a fun person to be around. People don't want to be around you. You bring them down. It's not thoughtful. It sounds like it. It does. I mean, bears that sound smarter than bulls. They do. They always have. They just are always wrong. You say, well, doesn't the market go up and down? Yeah, it does. But it relentlessly moves higher. I mean, I don't know what's hard about the concept. I truly don't know why it's so hard for people to understand that in a straight line, that what goes up must come down. No, not when it comes to stocks. Not when it comes to the economy. Not when it comes to the most abundant time that man has been on earth. There's nothing to be skeptical about. You don't have to walk around with blinders on and unaware and elect morons to the office because they sound good, but they have moronic policies. We tend to do that. I totally agree. And we should be skeptical and fight for what's right. Fight for freedom. Fight for economic freedom. Fight for your own personal life. Absolutely. Fight for the rights of your grandchildren not to be burdened by ridiculous amounts of debt. I get that. But when we carry that kind of skepticism, we miss thousands of points in the market. We miss the simple fact that the world has never been more abundant. Period. Period. Put whatever you want after it. Yeah, but, yeah, but, yeah, but, yeah, but. Keep going, yeah, but. I've heard it for 35 years. Yeah, but the deficits are so high in 1980. Yeah, but inflation is so high. Yeah, but the Soviet Union is so strong. Yeah, but. Yeah, but the tech bubble burst. Yeah, but the towers went down. Yeah, but they're just, it's all phony because they're just printing money. Yeah, but inflation is just around the corner. I can read blogs too. I can destroy any kind of semblance of positive attitude going forward. I can totally do that easily. It's not putting your head in the sand to say, this is the most abundant time man has been on earth, in the most abundant country on earth. Why am I a miserable person? Why do I decide to spread misery? Why do I make a decision every day to go forth and spread miserable economic news as some kind of thoughtful, skeptical outlook? That's not Pollyannish. I'm not being Pollyannish. I'm being a serious historian. But it's not keeping that way. Because there's so many yeah buts. Just turn on the news. But even better, go on some blogs. That's even better. Because you don't have to be accountable there. You don't have to be accountable to facts. You can pile up all kinds of things. You can take people's quotes out of context. Say, let's quote Warren Buffett, who thinks the world is ending. Well, actually, no, he doesn't. But if you take a few words out of it, maybe it could be put into a whole big blog about how the greatest investor of our time is thinking that everything is going bad and we should buy gold off of the website and then go execute. Nonsense. And I think it's important just to really remember this thought, okay? Being skeptical all of the time has been, currently is, and I believe will be extremely expensive for you. Our number is 580-5436. This is our final break. 580-KIDO. Final break today, yeah, because we're going to do a rerun. That's right. Neil Devlin is in the next hour. Give us a call. We'll be right back.
This is Money Matters with Dave Pezzo. Dave is taking calls right now. Call 580-5436, Idaho's place to talk. Money Matters with Dave Pezzo on 580-KIDO, Idaho's place to talk.
Hello, welcome, and thanks again for joining us. Hey, this is our last little segment today. Neil Devlin will be live segment. Neil Devlin. Like the number 10 employee for John Templeton, really, who, of course, as you know, talk about all the time. He certainly was a mentor of mine. I had the opportunity to meet him a couple of times, John Templeton, but this is a guy coming up here that's traveled the world with him and has some great insight and some great long-term thought, something that we just really don't have a lot anymore. Long-term perspective, long-term thought, patience. It's a very impatient world. I know it is. I know it's hard. And thank you for letting me talk with you about it, because, you see, it reminds me. It reminds me of the silliness of when I sit there and watch the day-to-day commentary, the moment-by-moment commentary, and how absolutely, hopelessly not helpful that is. It's not. It reminds me of that. It reminds me how we all are driven in this world of instant communications, instant news, to feel, and we have to be reminded of this, don't we, to feel that the world is better than it has been in the past. It doesn't feel that way. Not when we find anywhere in the big world. Yeah, in a galaxy sense, it's not very big. But there sure are a lot of people on this little earth, right? And so when some nut job somewhere blows some people up, cuts off their head, or does something totally evil, it's a tiny percentage of the population. But it's the amazing focus of the camera, commentary, 24-hour news flow on multiple things, including what I have in my hand, a telephone. You just can't stop it. And to think we just set that aside as so much, you know, yeah, I'm aware of that. It's not. Just being aware, it's reminding ourselves all the time of how difficult it is. It's very hard to set these things aside. It always is. It's just to see that maybe things will work out okay because you know what they have. And the reason why that's important is not just to spread joy and not, you know, depression. It's not that. It's critical to good investing to feel like the future might be okay. And the future has been okay. It's been okay for a long, long time. And yes, we're going to have bumps. We are. We always do. Anyway, thanks again for joining us. You know, you can hear the music, and we're just about out of here, and I do appreciate it. Next week, we're going to talk about a couple of really beaten-down sectors and whether maybe that makes some sense.
Looking for a way to get your business in front of thousands of potential customers? Secure your booth space for the 3rd annual Canyon County Kids Expo, Saturday, January 31st. It's a full day of kids' activities with clowns, face painting, magicians, bounce houses, slides, and all kinds of cool demonstrations. This is the perfect place to reach thousands of potential customers. Booth space is limited, so call today to secure your booth for the 3rd annual Canyon County Kids Expo. Call 275-8131 to learn more. That's 275-8131.
You want in?
Shark Tank Nation, Monty and Easy. Shark Tank Nation, our 5 nights a week.
I'll make you a million.
Just like that.
So take the deal.
You just got whacked.
Get hooked. Shark Tank, weeknights at 8 Eastern on CNBC.
Well, hello and welcome to a special edition of Money Matters. And I appreciate you giving me the time off this morning. But I will be live in the second hour, so hang on to your questions. Shoot those emails over. And that's dave@petsofinancial.net. So I will be live in the second hour. But I wanted to get with a guest we've had on before. And it's just really amazing that he's still bouncing around because it seems so many years ago that Sir John Templeton was running around the globe and running around the world with this gentleman that we're going to be talking with. And his name is Neil Devlin. He is a CFA. He's an executive vice president and portfolio manager with the Templeton Global Equity Group. But before I just start chatting with him, and I know everybody's got all these fancy pants titles, here's the fancy pants title that I think is amazing. He was the 10th employee hired by Sir John Templeton, which all of you know is a hero of mine, should be of everybody's. He's an amazing man, and certainly was an astounding investor. But the idea of this guy being able to travel the world with Sir John is just amazing, to go to all these different places and to gain that kind of perspective. But, Neil, I'm glad you're still kicking around and working. It obviously must be a real passion for you, and thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Dave. I look forward to speaking with your guests.
Well, let's start off with the question of the day, if you will, globally. And that, for me, this is really a strange world we live in, because all we ever seem to talk about, if you're talking about Wall Street gibberish, is the Fed. Everything's about the Fed. Are the corporate profits phony? Are the dividends phony? Is it all going to cave in if the Fed doesn't continue to buy bonds endlessly for the rest of our life? Or are there real earnings and real growth? Is it occurring out there within those corporations?
Dave, two of the sectors we really like, pharmaceuticals in the healthcare space and financials, since we talked about 6 or 7 months ago, have substantially improved, looking at just earnings, forgetting money supply and Federal Reserve policy. Both of those areas, I can take a bank that we own, like Citigroup, which has decreased its asset base by 50%. It's increased its return on equity over the last couple of years from 2-3% all the way to 7-8%, probably on the way to 12%. It's now making solid loans. It's eliminated parts and companies that couldn't meet their cost of capital. So it's basically shrunk to grow. And that you can see not only coming out in earnings, but Wall Street and investors like us that invested in the company are starting to see profits really start to improve. And the same's happening in the healthcare space. A number of the companies like Pfizer have eliminated parts of their business that weren't working, increased their return on equity, and that's being seen in higher dividends, but better return on equity and higher stock prices.
Now, we are seeing some clear-cut financial engineering, and you know, you mentioned pharmaceuticals. First thing I thought of was Merck selling billions of dollars worth of bonds. I believe it was or hundreds of millions. I thought it was around $1 billion, so that they could buy back more stock and increase the dividend. And obviously, that's great for stockholders, but it doesn't say anything about their pipeline and things like that fundamentally going forward. But it's not, if I'm hearing you right, this is not all financial engineering, is it?
No, there's some financial engineering, as you've mentioned, but the fundamentals are substantially better. If I look at any of the large pharmaceutical companies that we own, Pfizer, Roche, Merck, KGaA, Bayer, every one of these have stronger balance sheets, better dividend, better cash flow. Most of these companies could probably buy 50% of their stock back just from free cash flow. Sometimes that makes sense. As you're pointing out, it's becoming harder and harder for these companies just to buy their stock. And from a return of capital standpoint, we're hoping going forward they return it in the form of dividends as opposed to financial engineering, whether it be buying something offshore to lower their tax base, which sometimes makes sense if the pipeline improves from a fundamental standpoint, but if they're not doing it just strictly to lower taxes. But everything we see in the fundamental standpoint has substantially improved, and we would expect, looking out over the next 2 to 5 years, that it will continue to improve as well.
Are you at all concerned about the Fed getting out of the market? And if we can, let's also take that globally, because it does, you know, I want to tie this together with the interest rates and what's going on in Europe.
Sure.
As well. Is this something, is a whole lot of hot air? Let me just give you this classic example that I'm wondering about, because you hear people every day talk about the Fed and they're having active this or that. And I realize it's dead news summer, but this is just sounds so nonsensical to me that everything is about the Fed when they've been tapering for months and months now, actually a year, have they not?
Yes. When I started with Sir John in 1987, he asked me to look back, and in some ways the 70s and 80s had some correlation with what's happening now. But he was concerned as well in certain countries, U.S., Australia, if rates rose substantially, what had happened in the past. Looking back, he had me look back as far as I could, 70 years at that juncture from 1987, to equity prices if rates rose and rose substantially. I started on the fixed income side, and the worst year I could find was 1974, where rates rose about 50%. And equities in the short term, over a couple of months, did decline 3 to 5% off a substantial increase in the Fed funds rate. But by the end of the year, stocks were up from where they had been, from where the Fed started to raise rates. If I look at what central banks are doing globally, the Fed is certainly cutting back a bit, but it still has $4 trillion in cash in the system. The European Central Bank, ironically, looks like they're following what Greenspan, Bernanke, and even Yellen is doing today, and they have about $2.8 trillion in cash in the system. And they'll probably increase to $4 trillion as the European economies are coming under some pressure. Japan joined the party about a year ago and added $1.5 trillion of cash in dollars to the system, And Sean is talking about looking at doing a similar policy, probably around $1 trillion. So you have $12 to $13 trillion if you add up all of the cash that the central banks have put out there. If I look at the market cap of all stocks around the world, it's about $50 trillion. So you have almost a quarter of cash in the system that central banks around the world are supporting. I don't anticipate, and we don't really look at the policies of the central banks, but it would be unusual for the Fed to dramatically pull money out of the system. There's no inflation. They'll probably do it fairly slowly. What I think they're talking about now probably won't happen in 2015, and probably the second half of the year. There's no wage pressure, which is one of the things that's in their models and something they really monitor. And even though unemployment has come down from 8%, 9%, 10% to just over 6% where it is now, if you went back to 2008 and looked at the participation rate was much higher. It's down to 65% from 70%+. So if all those people were back working, you'd probably have 10% unemployment. So the Fed's certainly cognizant of this. So unlike the worst year I saw and Sir John Templeton had me look at in 1974 when the Fed did raise rates, I don't think central bank policy is going to impact the fundamentals, earnings, and or stock prices, certainly over the medium term, and I wouldn't even suggest this year.
Interesting. Now, as we look around the world, this is one of the, I just want to ask the fundamental question. Why would I buy a Spanish bond and not a U.S. bond? Why would I do that? The rates are similar, but people are doing it.
I think what's happening, and this is more fixed income than equity, we find some value in Spanish stocks like Telefonica, but most of the value is on the export side of the business. 60%+ of the earnings of the Spanish telecom comes from the export side and has piles of free cash flow from Argentina, Brazil, Mexico, and some in Asia. But I think on the fixed income side of the ledger, not the equity side, investors are looking at deflation and disinflation and a lack of growth in Europe. European growth started the year around 1%. Rates have come down. Spanish rates, Italian rates are through U.S. rates. So it's the deflationary anticipation by fixed income investors that things are going to get worse in Europe. If I look at so far the central bank response to that, I think it will be positive for stocks, probably not positive, and may even be negative for fixed interest investments and or utilities in my world on the stock side of the ledger. If rates do not go lower and start to pick up as the central bank starts to increase their balance sheet, and it looks like they will from $2.8 trillion to where the Fed is today, the U.S. Fed at $4.2 trillion. And my sense is Draghi is pretty, the new central bank head, took over from Trichet, is starting to do that. If I look at what's happening in the European banks from a fundamental standpoint, they now are able to borrow basically at zero, at 5-10 basis points. Under the Trichet, when he was running the ECB for the last 3 or 4 years, until Draghi took over a year and a half ago, you had to borrow at an average of 4 years. So the rate for banks, a number of the banks that were invested in to borrow from the central bank was 3.5%, 3.5%. Today, under Draghi, it's going to be 10 basis points. So Draghi's policies are extremely expansionary for business, for commerce, good for stocks, questionable for bonds and fixed income interest alone. But behind that, he's probably going to put almost double the amount of cash in the system that presently exists. So just like the U.S. in 08, 09, 2010, when we had our systematic challenges on the banking side for the 6,000-plus banks in the U.S., and it was questionable what liquidity would be there, and would the fundamentals improve, and could these banks increase their earnings in challenging economic times. There's almost a two-year lag. Europe is, should be a very similar correlation to the policies that took place in the U.S., and in the U.S. they've been very, very successful. If you look at what happened to banks and growth, both have improved substantially during that period of time.
Let's stay in that part of the world for just a minute because, you know, speaking of the banks over there, most people, or most people that are seem to be studying the banks over there are very uncomfortable with the balance sheets. But you also have a central banker over there that's saying, whatever it takes, we're not going to have a systemic failure. So are you, as bargain hunters, are you finding value in selective banks over there, or is it an area of huge concern for you?
No, we really like the European banks. They continue to trade from a valuation standpoint, probably 20-25% inexpensively to U.S. banks. The fundamentals, the banking system in Europe is large. It's four times the size of the U.S. The capital behind the banks is improving. If we look at what's happening to loan losses in general, loan loss reserves, the number of, whether it be personal loans, commercial loans, that are not being paid, that percentage is going down. So the quality of loans is improving on the lending side. The quality of defaults is declining. Home prices appear as though they're stabilizing after declining for two or three years. Wages in Europe have risen about 1.1% from the bottom. So GDP is kind of the one part of the equation that appears to be questionable. You know, after having a falling money supply by 2-2.5% for 4 or 5 years, you could argue that Draghi has turned it around from the Trichet era. And some people would argue even he is still too tight and could loosen up the purse strings a lot faster. Although most people would argue if he follows the Fed's lead and increases the money supply from 2.8 trillion where it is now to 4.2 trillion where the Federal Reserve put theirs, that should create a lot of liquidity and a much better business environment. But I think most importantly, you've gone from a very reactive European Central Bank to what appears to at least be a much more proactive European Central Bank. And that will be reflected in the banks. The banks can now borrow, even if they don't want to lend, at zero, at 5-10 basis points tops from the central bank. It'll probably be a pool of close to $4 trillion over the next year or so. And they don't even need to go lend money. They can do what the banks in the U.S. did and just recapitalize their balance sheet if it was a challenged balance sheet, if it was a Spanish bank, an Italian bank, an Irish bank. That was at the lower end of the spectrum as far as return on assets, return on equity, credit quality. They could just go out and buy basically treasuries, European Central Bank debt at 1-1.5 or even 2%, as you pointed out, just under U.S. yields. And if you're borrowing at 10 basis points, you can lever yourself 3, 4, 5 times and easily make a 10% return on equity without even going into the market and taking risk with consumers, whether they be commercial, industrial, or personal. The other thing that's changed substantially from what I would consider the bottom in European banks when they traded at 30-40% of book, they're now at about 70% of book, so they're up 50-60% from the bottom, is their capital levels. When I looked at these banks 2, 3, 4 years ago, they had no cushion, no cash, no equity. Everything was a pile of loans, and as analysts bottom up, we had to go through the loans and try and determine what was good and what was bad and haircut them as necessary. Now these banks, on average, have about 10% cash, 10% equity that they've built up over the last couple of years, either by selling businesses to get rid of parts of their business that was underperforming the cost of capital, or they've reliquified themselves by borrowing at 1, 2, 3% and investing in other assets, 4, 5, 6%, with that money from the central bank. So things fundamentally to us, looking at the banks, look very attractive. And we would argue over the next 2 to 3 years, they'll probably do something similar to what we anticipate U.S. banks will do. They'll return 11, 12%, which is kind of the long-term average for banks. They're at about 4 or 5 in Europe. They're about 6, 7 in the U.S., return on equity. And that's another 50, 60% in stock price appreciation if it can happen from where they are right now. So I think banks are in pretty good shape in the U.S. And pretty good shape in Europe as well.
Excellent, excellent. All right, we got to take a quick break here, and when we come back, let's continue our walk around the world with Neil Devlin, who is with the Templeton Equity Group, and believe it or not, the number 10 employee for Sir John Templeton. We'll be right back.
This is Money Matters with Dave Pezzo. Dave is taking calls right now. Call 580-5436, Idaho's place to KIDO, Idaho's place to talk.
And welcome back. Thank you so much for joining us. And I will be live in the second hour, so shoot those emails over, dave@petzofinancial.net. And also, of course, we'll be taking your calls in the next hour. But when I've got the opportunity to visit with Neil Devlin, who is with the Templeton Group and was the number 10 employee hired by Sir John Templeton, who is a mentor of mine, and I was fortunate to actually meet him a couple of times and spend a little bit of time with him. But Neil traveled the world with him, which is fascinating. And I've asked Neil to maybe share a story later on in this program about Sir John. He certainly was an amazing man. Right now, let's do some look at the world. And basically, let's talk about the headlines right now. Let's talk about what's going on in China. Everybody's worried about China. The market is down 50% or so from its highs. And, of course, when everybody has a love affair with things. But they're worried about the empty cities. They're worried about, you know, you're seeing books out now about the coming collapse of China. What do you think about China? How do you think about China, I guess, is a better way of phrasing it.
We like China, Dave. We've added a couple percent to the portfolio this year in a bunch of different industries. And I would expect going forward over the next couple of years, we could double 2, 3, 4% of the portfolios in China. Now that could become 5, 6, 7, 8%, and probably increase as more companies come to market in China. China has a new administration, new president and prime minister as of last year in November, and it really has taken them till now to put together what they consider their long-term planning. And the 13th five-year plan, which will go from 2015 to 2020, everything that we can see in that will be positive for growth, positive for the people, positive for the fundamentals of stocks, and should eventually be reflected in stock prices. China is one of the least expensive stock markets at this juncture, and that's caused by after a couple of years of raising interest rates. China now, S.J. Ping, who's the chairman, and Mr. Li, who's the president, are taking somewhat of a U-turn from going from the tired old export model of depreciating the currency and trying to manufacture widgets less than the rest of the world and basically exporting deflation to the U.S., Europe, and Japan. What they're doing is looking at the 8 major industry groups and looking at what companies they want to sponsor, the same way Germany did after World War II, and use industrial policy, basically use their cash, their name, their cachet, and try to have a couple of really strong companies in the banking sector, information technology, materials, and build their own consumption and their own economy up through those companies. What will happen is they're going to let some companies fail that aren't doing well, can't manage themselves, and in equity fundamental terms can't meet the cost of capital, but there'll be a number of companies that do very well. So from our standpoint as bottom-up equity analysts, it gives us a chance to shine and really find those companies that will do very well for the next 10 to 20 years and avoid the companies that probably will go out of business. So China is really changing what they're doing from a big picture standpoint. The other policy change is they've gone from tightening interest rates to joining the U.S. and Europe. As we talked about earlier, they'll probably be loosening monetary policy to make sure the economy continues to do well as they, from a secular standpoint, change their policy of how they look at business and how they look at their country. So everything we see happening in China is a plus going forward.
That's terrific. You know, what we'll do here is we're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, let's kind of roll that into maybe some emerging markets as well, the overall picture. Everybody got on this BRIC thing, and, of course, Russia's in that, and whether it's even investable is probably a huge question mark. But we'll go ahead and roll around the world a little bit more with Neil Devlin. We'll be right back after Fox News.
This is Money Matters with Dave Pezzo. Dave is taking calls right now. Call 580-5436, Idaho's place to talk. This is Money Matters with Dave Pezzo on 580-KIDO, Idaho's place to talk.
Hello and welcome back to Money Matters. I'm Dave Pezzo, and this is, of course, a special recording. When I get a chance to get a guy like Neil Devlin on, I just think it's such a treat. A global investor, a value investor, takes a different long-term look at the world instead of the headline news. It's a different way. As you know, on this show for years and years and years, I've tried to help all of us, myself included, try to slow down the fire hose full of information that comes at us every day and think a little longer term the way that Sir John Templeton did. And Neil, of course, was the 10th employee for Sir John, started in 1987. So, again, Neil, thank you so much for joining us. I really appreciate your time.
My pleasure, Dave.
Let's quickly go around the world, if you will. I mean, we kind of ended the last segment talking about China and leading into emerging markets. Why don't we kind of, if you would, kind of, how are things looking in Latin America? And then let's roll over to the satellites in Europe and go from there.
I think what's changed since 2000, when the emerging markets were in favor and very expensive, is they were looked upon as the BRICS and everything in emerging markets traded fairly uniformly, both from a valuation, a price standpoint, and in some cases, people put multiples on them that they probably shouldn't have had. We look at the emerging markets as very, very different depending on who they are and where they are. Latin America that you asked about, Mexico is almost a high beta U.S. economy. It's done very well. It's trying to open up its markets. It's doing a lot of the right things. Brazil has been very challenged. It's been with China and India, three of the worst performing stock markets of the last couple of years. Although it looks like they may start to do the right thing after doing the wrong thing from a fundamental standpoint for a couple of years. And then Argentina is close to bankrupt. If I go to Europe, Poland is and was doing very well. It's somewhat challenged by the Russia-Ukraine fallout, as it's right on the border of both of those countries. It has huge support from the U.S. and Europe, even though Europe has been fairly slow to react. The other troubled spots in the emerging markets to us are Turkey, which has a high deficit issue. But other than that, the emerging markets to us are extremely positive and bright. And as I look at the new names bottom up that we're finding of companies and businesses in the emerging markets, more and more stocks that we're finding value in are in the emerging markets area. As analysts bottom up, what Sir John Templeton always taught us to look at the markets is to look at, you know, the company value, the free cash flow value, what kind of cash can be generated. So all the noise you read on either the TV, CNBC, Bloomberg, or in the papers, when we look at companies bottom up, the better companies that we're investing in, the 80-plus companies that we like that are in the portfolio, are generating more and more free cash flow, and their fundamentals look better, and their earnings and eventually stock prices should fall, even though they may be in challenged areas, whether it's China or India or some of the other emerging markets. And the reason free cash flow is from my bottom-up analytical standpoint and Sir John's standpoint, very important, if not one of the most important ways to look at a business, is because we want to ensure that the company not only has enough cash to pay all the operating expenses of the business, but pay us either through increasing the dividend, buying back stock, or if it's a small cap, buying back shares. So from our standpoint, everything we see in the emerging markets is leading to higher free cash flow, and the valuations are pretty inexpensive. They've fallen 20 to 40% versus the developed markets over the last couple of years.
Now, in some of those, you probably, in yours, would not be involved in frontier markets, but as some of those frontier markets are in the Middle East, it makes me ask this question of you with all the fighting that's going on there. I know the fighting's not new. I don't remember in my lifetime that there isn't some turmoil there. But does this cause any long-term concerns for you with the additional turmoil of the big energy producers, particularly as it's pointed towards European companies?
No. Historically, what's happened is companies have always found ways around the challenges of war, pestilence, economic issues, depression, so forth. We own an Israeli company called Teva, and it's a very, very good business. Most of its manufacturing is not in the Middle East. It's more of a shell company in the Middle East. It mostly manufactures pharmaceuticals. And on the generic side out of Philadelphia, and they've bought into Japan, which will be a huge growing market for generics. The government of Japan wants to increase generics from 10-11% where it is now to 25%. So Teva will be a major beneficiary of that. If you look at what's happened to this Israeli company and the stock price during this whole spat with Hamas and West Bank, East Bank in Gaza, the stock's up 20%. So Sir John always taught us to look through all the noise, look out to the five-year period of time, buy pessimism, buy what people aren't buying,
mm-hmm.
and eventually a lot of these issues will solve themselves.
Excellent, excellent. All right, we're due for a little bit of a break here, and when we come back, let's check out the rest of the world. I want to talk Japan. I mean, that's got a massive amount of debt, and they're trying a whole new experiment here. Let's get more debt. And we'll be right back.
This is Money Matters with Dave Pezzo. Dave is taking calls right now. Call 580-5436, Idaho's place to talk. Money Matters with Dave Pezzo on 580 KIDO, Idaho's place to talk.
Hello and welcome to Money Matters. I'm Dave Pezzo, and this is a special recording. I'm here with Neil Devlin. If you're just tuning in, he's with the Templeton Group and was one of the first employees that Sir John Templeton hired. And we've been kind of going around the world, so let's click off the last couple of hot spots, if you will. Neil, why don't you run us through Japan and what they're doing, this whole idea that Japan is now, you know, whatever, a zillion times GDP, they're going to borrow, and it's a pretty big experiment that truly no country that I know of has ever come back from that much debt. And also, can you speak to what's going on in Russia and whether you're actually doing any buying in Russia And if you are, how in the world can you do that?
Sure. In the case of Japan, Abe has pushed three arrows. The first was to depreciate the currency, and that was a pretty easy thing to do. You just sell yen, and that worked. He's gone from 68.69 to the dollar all the way to 104, and it's probably going to 120, so he'll depreciate it close to 20%. He'll probably do another 10 at least. The second arrow was to create some inflation and pull the country out of 20 years of deflation, as well as lower their debt to GDP as a government, which is close to 180%. It's the highest in the world. So if you inflate your currency and inflate your economy, by definition, whoever your holders of the debt will have less value by the price of that inflation increase. And that's working. So he's gone from, call it deflation of 2 to 4% to inflation of plus 2%, which is what he's targeting over the next 2 to 3 years. The hard part is the third arrow, and that's really opening the markets as well as opening the labor markets. As a general rule, women do not work in the working force. He's trying to pull them back in. He needs to open up the labor markets, which have been closed for years. Japan is a bunch of interlocking partnerships. So if you and I have a company, we may not share the profits and cash flows with our shareholders. We just kind of give whatever numbers we want to give to the shareholders, and we keep a fair amount for ourselves, either locked in the valuation of the company or locked in the equity of the company. So opening the markets up, opening the companies up is going to be very challenging. And then finally, the people that put him in office are the farmers in the rural sector. It's not the people in Tokyo. And the markets he needs to most open up are the commodity and agricultural side, which have close to 800% tariffs on it. So he has some fair challenges. As we look at the markets, we have about 3-4% in Japan. It's been very challenging for us, even the last 20 years, since the 70s, to find good companies that would double over 5 years. And the reason for that is because Japan has all these tariffs, doesn't open up their markets, their return on equity is about half the return of all the other stocks around the world. So even now, if I look at some of the Japanese banks, like the big banks, SMFG, they trade around 0.8 times price to book. If that was an open market company, we'd buy it tomorrow because it should easily double to 2 times price to book, which is where most banks go. But it's not, so that's the challenge. I think he's trying, and it's an experiment, and we'll see how it works. But for us, we're still finding better companies in almost every industry of the 8 major industry groups elsewhere. In the case of Russia, we have found a couple of names and put them on the bargain list, and they're finding their ways into the portfolio. One of the most interesting businesses is a company called Norilsk. And even with the whole Russia-Ukraine mess, it's up close to 15% in the last 2 or 3 months. And the reason for that is nickel, its major commodity, is down 75%. And we've always bought what other people didn't want, and nickel cycle's coming back because the auto and aerospace cycle's coming back. And the second reason is that the expenses of the company are in rubles, and the assets, nickel, commodity, are in dollars.
Right.
So the spread between those two is leading to higher operating margins. And this company pays a 10% dividend, and the math behind doubling over 5 years is 15% a year for 5 years.
Right.
So a couple percent growth, this stock looks like a real winner over the next 5 years.
Good point. All right, we got to take our final break, and when we come back, let's Neil's going to share a story of all of his travels with Sir John. We'll be right back.
This is Money Matters with Dave Petzo. Dave is taking calls right now. Call 580-5436, Idaho's place to talk. Petzo on 580 KIDO, Idaho's place to talk.
Hello and welcome back, and thank you again for joining us this special edition. Now, again, I will be live, well, you know, basically in 5 minutes. So I will be live in the second hour, so feel free to hang on and shoot those questions over if you would. And also, you can shoot those over to Dave at PetzoFinancial.net. But again, anytime I get an opportunity to talk to a global investor, somebody that has a great passion, obviously, for the business, he's been highly successful over his career, and also traveled the world with Sir John Templeton. We want to take the time to try to learn some of that wisdom from him. So I'm here again with Neil Devlin. I appreciate all your time today, Neil. But I want to really in this last segment, if you would, give us some of the wisdom, if you will, that you've sucked out of John Templeton all the years you traveled the world with him. And he's such a wise, wise man. You must have just, you know, have a million stories. But if you'd share one with us, we'd sure appreciate it.
Sure. When I started with Sir John, I was 28 years old, about 31 years ago. And he was close to 78 years old. And my first 3 years, I was the 10th person he hired in 87. We spent literally going around the world. This was pre-computers. So everything we did really was bottom-up analysis. The company at that juncture was very, very small. I mean, we probably had $40 million in stocks, bonds, under management. And Sir John had been doing it and had a very, very strong record for 40 years. And when we'd sit, literally, and we'd start in January, and we'd go around the world looking at where the least expensive companies were, and not that the stocks that were down the lowest in price, but the stocks that were lowest in price to what we would do on the back of an envelope.
Money Matters is brought to you in part by Petzo Financial Consultants and Mountain West Bank, Idaho's community bank with offices in Boise, Ketchum, and Coeur d'Alene. Dave Petzo, the host of Money Matters, is a certified financial planner professional and an investment advisor representative with Cambridge Investment Research Advisors Incorporated. Registered representative securities offered through Cambridge Investment Research Incorporated, a broker-dealer member FINRA SIPC. Investment advisor representative Cambridge Investment Research Advisors Incorporated, a registered investment advisor. Cambridge Investment Research Incorporated and Petzo Financial Consultants are not affiliated companies. These are the opinions of Dave Petzo and are based on information from sources believed to be reliable but may change as information changes or becomes outdated. Nor should any opinion contained herein be construed or considered as a solicitation to buy or sell any particular investment product. Indices mentioned are unmanaged and cannot be invested into directly. Asset allocation and diversification strategies cannot fully guarantee against loss. The past performance does not guarantee future results.